funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How would a massive electronic attack affect the security of the United States, and how prepared are government and private industry networks to fend one off? My guest today is deeply concerned about the security of Internet-linked information sources, government agencies, and infrastructure and utility systems, which can't be protected by traditional military power but could cause crippling damage if our enemies were to gain access to them. Joel Brenner is former senior counsel at the National Security Agency. His new book is called America the Vulnerable, Inside the New Threat Matrix of Digital Espionage, Crime, and Warfare. Joel, welcome to Think.
Thanks a lot, Chris. I'm real happy to be here.
So if we keep up with the headlines, we've heard about WikiLeaks. We've heard about the Stuxnet attacks on the Iranian nuclear enrichment facilities. We hear all the time about thieves gaining access to personal data. It seems, though, that these attacks are in some ways just the tip of the iceberg.
Well, I don't know if they're exactly the tip of the iceberg so much as they are the big opening wedge of a new kind of attack. What's happened as the public wasn't watching is that by connecting virtually all of our operational functions to our IT systems, that's to say our information technology systems, we've made operations vulnerable in the same way that information has become vulnerable. Because if you can penetrate an information system to steal information from it, and we all know that that's happening around the clock, you can also penetrate it to change the information in it or to shut down some operation that depends on it. That's what's going on.
It is only in recent years that an attack from the Internet could have the potential to take down something as massive as, say, a public utility. Talk about the pros and cons that have played into decisions to create systems that could be remotely accessed.
Well, I think the big issue here is the electric grid. The grid is controlled. That's to say the power generation facilities, the big generators, are controlled by what the engineers called industrial control systems, sometimes called also SCADA systems. And these are the electronic devices that regulate the power on the grid. And they make decisions faster than even the most expert human being could make them. And they keep a kind of equilibrium, and they calibrate many, many different controls across a very widespread geographical space. Not just in a big state like Texas, but across the country, sometimes internationally. And so the people who own these systems naturally are looking for efficiencies in managing them. We can't blame them for that one bit. But one of the ways they've tried to create efficiencies is to take systems that were designed to be kept under lock and key and not to be controlled or connected to the public Internet, and they've connected them to the Internet for reasons that I think are really unwise, to gain very small efficiencies in operations, in the course of which they've taken these generators and made them vulnerable to electronic attacks, just like the banks and the credit card issuers and everybody else who holds information, whether it's your employer or your university or anything else. And that strikes me as really rash. And what it does is to subject every business and household that depends on electricity, which of course is everybody, to risks that the power generators decide to take. And their toleration for that risk is pretty high, because studies show that if you ask these fellas who they expect would have to pay if there were a big blackout, they give three answers. One of the answers is ratepayers, that's you and me and your listeners. And another answer is the insurance company. And the third answer is the U.S. government, which is also you and me and your listeners who pay taxes. So their taste for risk is pretty high. But they're taking risks on behalf of the whole society, and I think it's very, very rash, and it presents the risk that, not that the whole country would go dark, I think that's science fiction, but that a whole region could go dark. I mean, do you remember, Chris, about, I don't know, it was only 5 weeks ago or so now, that San Diego, mm-hmm. the power went off in San Diego for some hours,
yeah.
and nobody could figure out why? Well, there's been an explanation put out for that. It's kind of, you know, run-of-the-mill. It was somebody made a decision or flipped a wrong switch. But if that sort of thing can happen by accident, it can be made to happen. And we know we've had big blackouts that have been economically crippling for a while. The last one was in, really major one was in 2003. It started in Ohio, and it affected up from Canada all down through the East Coast and the near part of the Midwest. And I don't say that was caused by mischief. It wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if that sort of thing happens, then big parts of the country go dark. It's terribly, terribly worrisome, I think.
And the other interesting thing about something like a blackout, and I lived through one in El Paso about 15 years ago where the whole city went down, and ultimately it was caused by wind or something not nefarious. But it's strange how terrifying it is when it's the whole city. Even though it was broad daylight at the time, there's something very frightening, and people respond in strange ways.
Right, and think about if it's a whole region.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and this is... The economic consequences of this could be very, very grave, but also the national security consequences could be very grave. Let's go back to San Diego, for example. That's the biggest United States port for the U.S. Navy on the West Coast. And Seattle's the other big one. I mean, if one could make power go out in those two places during a diplomatically really tough spot where we were thinking of, flexing some military and naval muscle, you know, our options could be affected by that. And, and if there were, God forbid, a more general war, the ability to take out the other side's power would be a tremendous advantage. I just don't know why we would allow that to happen to ourselves, and it is happening to us now.
What kind of security clearance is typically required of people who have access to these systems, let alone those who might hack in from outside?
Well, none. I mean, these are private. Security clearances are issued by the government mm-hmm. for access to classified government information. And private companies, no matter how sensitive their information, will generally want to protect it, but there's no such thing as a security clearance that applies to a private information in a utility. And ordinarily we say, well, that's fine, because that who has a better incentive than the particular business to protect that particular business's secrets, assuming they understand the risks.
Mm-hmm.
But for reasons I've explained, utilities are in an unusual position because they don't really bear the risk of failure. I mean, if you and I go into business and we're manufacturing shoes or widgets or air conditioners or something, and we take a really foolish risk with our business and we go bankrupt, then you and I and our partners or our shareholders are the ones that suffer. But if the utility takes those risks, it's going to look to the ratepayers, the insurance companies, and the government to take the risk. And that's why the risk is being seriously underpriced now by the utilities.
What is particularly insidious about some of these threats is that it's possible to plant the seeds of an attack now and then activate them in the future. Can you talk a little bit about why these incursions are so hard to detect?
Well, you know, ordinarily, up until very recently, the distinction between espionage or reconnoitering and actually taking a hostile act toward another country has been very, very clear. Espionage is not an act of war. You know, it's as old as the hills. It's in the Bible. It's not a new line of work. If it's not the oldest profession in the world, it's the second oldest profession in the world. But putting espionage onto electronic channels really changes that, because if somebody else is in your electricity grid, how do you know whether they're just looking around to understand it, that's espionage, or whether they are actually planting malware that could be like a logic bomb or something that could be set off later in the event of hostilities? And you don't. And the reason that you don't is that we don't know how to test for the presence of something like a logic bomb. Hmm. We don't know how to vet software to find in several million lines of code to find the dozen lines that really are really bad. We just don't know how to do that. And that's why we can't have any confidence that if somebody were doing that in our systems, that we'd know about it. So consequently, the passing this stuff off as, well, they're just looking around or it's just espionage, really doesn't give me any comfort anymore. And I don't think it should give your listeners any comfort either, because we've made these systems just terribly, terribly vulnerable. I mean, you know, most people don't realize it, Chris, but the Internet was not created for the purposes we use it for now. It was originally, it was a brainchild of the late 1960s, and it was a device that some geniuses created for allowing a small trusted number of government and university researchers to collaborate across the country, which is to say you could bring geographically diverse brain power together to collaborate on a problem real easily. It was wonderful. But it shocks people when I tell them that until 1992, it was against the law to use the Internet for commercial purposes.
Wow.
That's pretty astonishing. I mean, that's less than 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, up until about 10 years ago, there was very, very little Internet commerce because people didn't trust it. And I remember the, you know, okay, I'll buy a book, I'll see what happens. You know, but now the amount of Internet commerce is stupendous. And we use this as a backbone for our commerce, for buying and selling, for our financial systems, increasingly, for, as I've explained, for operating systems, for military command and control. And it's a porous system that was designed with no security layer to it. And so this is why we're in this predicament at a personal, corporate, and national level. We're transparent.
So instead of sort of building, purpose building this whole system for the potential threats that might come around, we have found ourselves in most cases responding after the fact.
I'm afraid that's true, Chris. We go, and you know, if you look at the proposals that are made for Internet security, like even the legislation now, we want to raise the criminal penalties. Well, that's just a way of saying if we catch them, we'll punish them more. But it doesn't make us any more secure to do that. And it's pretty demonstrably the case that that is not a very significant deterrent, especially since a lot of this crime originates from overseas. A lot of it, you know, these crooks who are really well organized and really smart businessmen, they're crooks, but they're running a business. And they go to places like certain countries in West Africa or Eastern Europe where there are either no laws against this kind of crime or the laws are badly enforced or you can bribe people not to enforce them. And so they're often beyond the reach of the statutes that would punish them seriously if we catch them, because usually we don't catch them.
Joel Brenner is my guest. He's former senior counsel at the National Security Agency. He's author of the new book, America the Vulnerable, Inside the New Threat Matrix of Digital Espionage, Crime, and Warfare. If you'd like to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Joel Brenner. He is former senior counsel at the National Security Agency and author of the new book, America the Vulnerable, Inside the New Threat Matrix of Digital Espionage, Crime, and Warfare. If you'd like to join our conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Joel, let's talk about your experience with the NSA. You found yourself frustrated at times with the level of not only preparation for cyber attacks, but recognition in some cases that these could be extraordinarily damaging.
Well, almost. Let me make a distinction between some agencies that your listeners may not be familiar with. Between stints at NSA, where I was first the inspector general and then senior counsel, I also ran counterintelligence policy and strategy for the Director of National Intelligence. That's the official that was created in 2004 with the big intelligence reform, whose job is to kind of integrate and stitch together the various agencies. And so I was working for him. My job was to stitch together counterintelligence. And when it was that job, not the NSA job, where I was quite astounded by what I found when I got there. The Office of Counterintelligence at the DNI was neither resourced nor staffed or organized to deal with cyber espionage. It had not progressed beyond counter espionage, but spy catching.
Mm-hmm.
Even though for some years before that, we had seen a big push by a lot of espionage agencies into cyber espionage. So we were out trying to catch spies, and that problem never goes away, Chris. I mean, it's as I was saying before, it's as old as the hills. But something new was going on, and we were the organization that was in charge of government policy on espionage, counter-espionage, and we weren't even, that office, as I found, it wasn't paying attention to that. So I fixed that. When I got there, we had a national intelligence strategy. Intelligence includes counterintelligence. But there was no mission objective in that whole strategy for counterintelligence. I was flabbergasted. And so I worked very hard to beat the drum on this issue, and by the time I left, or as I was leaving, the new strategy actually calls out both cybersecurity and counterintelligence as main issues for the intelligence community. So I was very happy with that. That's occasionally, people get things right in the government, and so things were moving in the right direction. But it was just a wake up call. I mean, In the intelligence and the spy business may not have changed for thousands of years, but there have been two changes that I saw, really major changes, just in the last 10 years. One of them, as I've been explaining, is the remote cyber espionage. Because if you can penetrate somebody's information system from thousands of miles away and suck information out of it, maybe you don't need to train and send a spy to another country to try to take that information out. Because electronically, you can get a lot more information, you can get it with a lot less risk. So we saw this big explosion of cyber espionage. And the second change we saw was the targeting was shifting. It used to be espionage was just political military stuff. It was the intelligence agencies, the military, the White House. That sort of thing were always targets. But now we're seeing businesses in America and in Europe, Japan, South Korea, being targeted by espionage agencies and groups that they sponsor. That's really new and different. And it's terrifying. It surprises a lot of business people, some of my clients, when I explain to them that they are now being targeted the way the Pentagon is being targeted for the technology that makes them valuable. This is a really new development.
Something like the Google attack in 2008. Is that what
good
you're
example.
Referring to?
Mm-hmm. I mean, good example. The Google attack was startling not only for the advertised reasons that Google was being used as a tool of suppression of dissent, no big surprise there, but the Chinese actually got into Google to steal their source code. I mean, Google is a great company because of its special sauce. I mean, it's a terrific company. One goes to Google very often, not necessarily, but in preference to another search engine, if you do that, because you think it's really smart. They have algorithms. They have formulas that produce search results that are very good. Others are also good, but they were the first ones to really perfect this. And the Chinese also compete with Google, and they were using their intelligence apparatus to attack Google. One has to suppose for the benefit of Google's Chinese competition. And it wasn't just Google. Through Google, they got to hundreds or even thousands of Western companies. And that's a really new kind of development. Now, I go to business people and explain this to them, and the first reaction is, for many of them, is, well, that's Google. They're a huge company. Or, you know, General Dynamics may have this problem because they work for the Defense Department, but I'm just an emerging company. I'm not interesting to the Chinese or the Russians or the Iranians. Mm-hmm. And that's wrong, because these foreign intelligence agencies and their political leaders understand that they can't compete with the United States militarily, diplomatically, or any other way unless they can compete with us economically. And so they are trying to catch up by stealing what they can't invent themselves.
Is there any reason to believe that theft of U.S. intellectual property ultimately, although it does extraordinary damage to American innovators' profits, does it ultimately retard the independent development of new technology by China, by Russia, by Iran, by all these other places that are stealing our information?
I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting question. The Chinese watched the Japanese confront the United States economically. I mean, in a peaceful, competitive way, and they saw that one of the reasons the Japanese didn't succeed is that they did not have an entrepreneurial culture. They were copycats, brilliant engineers, brilliant at product development, but not brilliant at thinking new thoughts and of inventing new technology, which is something we're real good at in the United States. And they're determined to avoid that problem. They spend a lot of time trying to create an entrepreneurial culture, but they haven't succeeded, at least not yet. And it's one thing to want to do it. It's another thing to pull it off. It's very hard to do that in a country like China, where information is controlled. I mean, the reason we're so good at it, or one reason we're so good at it and so inventive, is that it's enormous ferment of free communication. Lots, some of it silly, some of it, you know, useful, some of it not useful, but it's this big ferment of unrestricted communication that makes this possible, and curiosity, and people who aren't afraid to challenge the old ways of doing things. That's so far not how China works at all. So I don't know. I can't think that the fact they've stolen a certain technology, or the Russians have stolen certain technology, is going to make them less entrepreneurially inclined. I just think it's if they don't succeed at this, Chris, it's not going to be because they've stolen too much. It's because it will be because they haven't invented enough.
Joel Brenner is with us. We're talking about his new book, America the Vulnerable. Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Brett on the line in Louisville. Hello, Brett.
Hey, Chris. How you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Great. Yeah, I was watching a show the other day that talked about a division in the NSA that actually was responsible for checking components that go into government computers and military computers. And they were finding that almost 10% were infected with some form of malware or something in that. And when you extrapolate that out to the general public, that's a huge number. And I just wondered if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Hi, Brett. I want to distinguish for a minute between finding malware we've never seen before and finding malware we know about. And what I was when I was saying we don't know how to vet code before, I was talking about finding malware we've never seen before. Because if you want to filter out bad stuff that in traffic, the electronic traffic, you have to know what it is to filter out. And that's what you buy a firewall for. But the firewalls don't catch things they've never seen before. So in this experiment you're talking about, NSA was looking for stuff we already knew about, which is most of it. And I wasn't at all surprised. I'm not surprised to hear a 10% figure. The figure is much, much higher in the country in general. If you McAfee and Symantec, which make the McAfee and Norton firewalls that are readily two of the many products that are available like this, put out studies from time to time quantifying the malware they find in the systems they look at. And on their websites, you can find those studies. They're real interesting. And 10% is pretty low. And it's particularly high in machines that are used by people who click willy-nilly on advertisements and on attachments to emails from people they don't know, because a lot of that stuff is corrupted.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. I'm curious about how up-to-date international law is in dealing with cases of cyber espionage and intellectual property theft.
Well, espionage is not against international law. And everybody does it to some degree. Although I want to make a really important distinction here. I'm often asked, well, don't we do this kind of espionage too? And the answer is no. Economic espionage for the benefit of American companies, we don't do, though a number of our adversaries don't believe that.
Mm-hmm.
I've been inside, and I can tell you it's not true. And it's not true for a couple of good reasons. It's a bedrock principle of American foreign policy that we try to spread throughout the world that the principles and enforcement of intellectual property law. That means that when Hollywood sends a movie somewhere in Asia or Europe, it's not going to get pirated, or it does, depending on how that's enforced. It means that when somebody uses or copies a patented invention in an Asian country, that they'll be stopped or not, and so on. So the enforcement of intellectual property is hugely important for the United States. Oh, 15 years ago, I think the average percentage of intellectual property on the balance sheet of American corporations was probably 20%, and fixed capital was 80%. That's reversed now.
Hmm.
So protecting that intellectual property is a foundational issue with us. So we're not going to go abroad and steal somebody else's intellectual property for the short-term advantages to an American company and the long-term detriment of our ability to advocate this basic point. And the second reason we don't do it, say, Chris, if you were going to be really cynical about it and say, well, maybe we could get away with it, why don't we try it, we're good at espionage. What do we want to steal from China or Russia? Russia is a country that in the year of 2011 has still not been able to manufacture and develop and market a commercially viable computer chip. This is a highly educated country, but deeply not entrepreneurial. So they don't have a lot of technology we want to steal, and the Chinese don't either, though they may develop it, but they don't right now. So even if you're a cynic about international law and stuff, you know, we're a target. We're a big fat. We're the biggest, fattest target in the world. But we don't steal intellectual property for the benefit of American companies.
On the other hand, if you look at a digital warfare, if you can take down a target with virtually no risk to innocent human lives, as in the case of the Iranian Stuxnet incident, the masterminds of which for now remain unidentified, although there's been speculation about U.S. involvement, I mean, there are certain advantages to fighting war this way.
There are, but there are also disadvantages. And one of the disadvantages is that containing the damage is not only hard, but I think it's right to say one doesn't really know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Go back to Stuxnet, which you brought up. That was the, for your listeners' benefit, that was the operation that involved the insertion of malware into the control systems that governed the Iranian nuclear centrifuge array that they were using to enrich uranium, surely for to create a bomb. And whoever disrupted it brilliantly did so by making those centrifuges go haywire and really produce physical damage in them to a big percentage of their centrifuges, and stopped their, probably slowed that, slowed down the Iranians in their ability to develop a weapon for, some people say, 3 to 5 years. I don't have an independent view about that, but some significant period of time. It was also less well advertised in the press that there were a large number of affected systems outside of Iran, around the world. That's what you'd call collateral damage. Now, it also, in the same way, you know, why didn't we take down the Iraqi banking system before we went into Iraq, either in the first Gulf War or in the current conflict? Because we didn't know. We couldn't know that it wouldn't also take down the banking system in Saudi Arabia or Egypt or Switzerland.
So you essentially opened Pandora's box when you do
this. It would have opened an enormous Pandora's box, and it could have caused financial havoc around the world. So containing the damage that this sort of attack has the capability of causing is very difficult.
Joel Brenner, we need to take a quick break here. Joel Brenner is my guest. His new book is called America the Vulnerable, Inside the New Threat Matrix of Digital Espionage, Crime, and Warfare. Join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former senior counsel at the National Security Agency and author of the book America the Vulnerable, Inside the New Threat Matrix of Digital Espionage, Crime, and Warfare. If you would like to speak with Joel Brenner, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Malcolm on the line in Dallas. Hi, Malcolm.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am in Dallas. I've been doing internet software development for businesses for 12 or so years. And reading recently about what I should really be doing to make my applications secure, I was impressed and kind of frightened by how little I knew. And as your guest has already mentioned, the internet doesn't really provide a lot of intrinsic security mechanisms. It really pushes the responsibility of securing applications onto individual developers and development teams. And I just wonder what he could talk about in regards to the lack of emphasis placed on the software community on this particular topic, because this applies really not only to internet applications, but operating systems and installed applications and on and on.
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Joel?
Malcolm, that is really a smart question. Let me make sure the listeners understand just what you've asked. Malcolm's pointing out that when you buy an application, that's an app, to go on your PC, your Mac, or your smartphone, you are buying software that somebody like Malcolm has developed for some cool purpose. The problem is we don't know how to rate those things for security, and for the reasons I was saying before, we don't know how to vet code. And some of these things are really squirrely, which is why Apple, for example, one reason why Apple is tough about what they will let on to their system. And the fact is we don't know how to price these things, because everybody says their stuff is secure, and so the public doesn't know how to pick and choose between them. Now, I would say this, though, Malcolm, because you're right, that increasingly the application level is where a lot of malware is directed. And some of these things are developed in ways with terrible vulnerabilities in them. Some of them are obvious, like buffer overflows and so on. I mean, I don't know why anybody ever tolerates that sort of thing anymore. Buffer overflow, listeners, well, why don't you explain it, Malcolm?
Let's bring him back on the line. Malcolm, can you explain buffer overflow for us?
Sure. Well, when an application is using memory, it has to allocate or request that memory be allocated from the operating system. And if it requests a bit more than is really available by the operating system, or it demands more, then it can cause the actual operating system to break underneath the application itself.
And can allow the overflow exploiter to overwrite code that's already there and put something else there instead. It's an easy method of attack. And there's an awful lot of software that's still written today and that is in a lot of people's machines that allows this kind of pretty elementary attack to take place. And so what we don't have is something like a consumer's report or an underwriter's laboratory that looks at code for even these elementary issues that we do know how to test for. And it would be a great service if the American computer science and electrical engineering professions would begin to develop a rating system. And it wouldn't catch everything, but it would begin to raise the quality of software that was being written and was being inserted into the devices that Chris and I and Malcolm and all you listeners use all the time. Nobody's doing that right now. And it could be very powerful because, among other things, if people allowed on their systems software that hadn't passed this kind of test, then it would create a liability problem for them. And we would all know, you know, not to load this kind of software because it didn't have somebody's a seal of approval on it. This could be very powerful. A few years ago, when Consumers Reports gave a do not buy recommendation to a certain SUV, Toyota took it off the market the next day. We don't have anything like that in software. So anyway, that's my answer, Malcolm. It's a great question. Thanks.
And he passed the pop quiz beautifully. What are the challenges, Joel, of recruiting qualified talent to work on some of these problems for the federal government when they could likely earn a great deal more in the private sector?
That's a problem of government in general at different levels. Mm-hmm. Actually, at many levels, the government is a highly attractive place to work. It pays well and has good benefits. But at the high end, it's not. If you're a federal judge, it's not just, you know, code writers. If you're a federal judge, you make less money than a second or third year associate in a big city law firm.
Yeah. I mean,
this is wrong, but it's the way, you know, it happens right now. It's not always at all periods of history like this, but it has been for some time. And so this is an issue at the higher levels of government. At the same time, for a taxpayer who's maybe having a hard time making ends meet and seeing a civil servant making $180,000 or more, you know, that seems objectionable to them. But the fact is, as you're suggesting, that if you can't pay the going rate for talent, you're not going to get the best talent. I don't know just how bad that problem is right now. I think that I'm not sure that government's having a very hard time hiring programmers at this issue. I can't speak authoritatively to that one, Chris.
I'm curious about your assessment on this question. Our financial system is heavily tied into the internet, and the industry has been a leader thus far in security. What can other commercial enterprises or even, you know, the U.S. Department of Defense learn from the way financial transactions are conducted online?
Well, financial transactions are conducted in ways that are somewhat more expensive. Well, let's say if you go into certain banks, for example, you can't get in unless you not only have a code, but then they'll show you a secondary code that you have to, you know, go through to get into your account, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go to, let's say, browse the catalog of a department store in Dallas or in Hong Kong, for that matter, if you're in Dallas, because you don't have to go to Hong Kong to do that now. We don't need a lot of security. We want to have this be cheap and easy. But there are many companies that just don't protect themselves. Let me put it to you this way. We have some big technological issues with the internet that I was talking to later. But most of the insecurities in most companies aren't technological. They're management. They're managerial. Because the failure to implement available technology is not a technological problem. That's a management problem. And so if a company wants to be secure, they have to think at the strategic, the really high level, of doing three things. One is they have to know who's on their system. And they have to regulate who can be on their system. Two, they have to know what hardware and software are running on their system, because as I explained in the book, there's certain kinds of hardware and software that are really dangerous to run because they create vulnerabilities and so on. And if you let everybody on your system decide what they're going to run, then you let every person on your system decide how much risk to take with your corporate property. Most companies don't do that. The third thing you have to do is to be able to know what traffic is running through your system, and even fewer companies do that. So unless you do all these things, you can't begin to achieve a high level of security. It wouldn't be perfect security, but you could really raise the boats. And it's startling to me, Chris, how many companies don't do any of these things, let alone all of them. I mean, I see investigations now that I get to look at from the inside of companies that, you know, I would have said, boy, that company in that line of business is probably really good at corporate security, and they are wide open. These aren't sophisticated problems. What it means is that management either doesn't understand the issue or underprices the risk.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a big problem right now. This is a big problem. This is part of why I wrote the book, to wake people up.
It sounds a little like, you know, the classic story of people who change their locks and get a burglar alarm after they've been broken into at home.
Well, at least when you do that, the next time it may be harder to break into your house.
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing cases where even after repeated break-ins, people aren't doing stuff. Although, you know, when a company suffers a serious loss, it tends to concentrate the mind. That's quite true. It'd be nice to be able to persuade people to get more secure before they have that break-in, but it's hard.
Is the average American at greater risk from cyber terrorism or even state-sponsored attacks or from garden-variety criminals trying to steal their money?
Ah, garden-variety criminals. That's an easy one. Let me address this phrase cyber terrorism, because although I am on a mission to raise consciousness about this general issue, I think cyber terrorism is hyped. Terrorism, you know, is a violent act aimed at intimidating people from doing things. If somebody plants a bomb in a waste can on a Dallas street corner, they make people afraid to go into the street. If they do that in a shopping center, they make people afraid to shop. It frightens people. It changes behavior. It exercises a power out of proportion to the resources available to somebody who plants a bomb like that. But I'm talking about sabotage, which is really not terrorism. I mean, if somebody takes down the power grid in a part of Texas, it's not going to make people afraid to put their lights on in the future. It's not really a terrorist act. It's either a state act of aggression, or it's a criminal act done to extort money from the owner of a system that's threatened or taken down. So I think that the notion of cyber terrorism, well, I think we ought to just be very careful about using that phrase. We're talking about organized crime. We're talking about sabotage. And at the extreme, we're talking about possibilities of war. But I don't think we're talking cyber terrorism. I don't talk about that.
How well, Joel, do you think that U.S. lawmakers understand the nature of these threats?
Well,
come on, you're off the government payroll.
Let me be careful, because I live in Washington. I got to go up on the Hill now and then. I'll say it's extremely uneven.
Mm-hmm.
It's like on most issues on the Hill. You know, you have 535 legislators of varying experience and wattage, let's say, and you find some people who know a lot about some issues and next to nothing about others. That's normal. It's how could it be otherwise? But I have to say that in general, the level of sophistication on the Hill on this issue is not very high. It's not very high. It's getting higher. People are beginning to understand this level, this issue at a better level. What you want is to make people begin to take something seriously without becoming hysterical about it. That's why, although in my book I have some very interesting scenarios that might involve war or the possibility of war or war avoided on bad terms, I don't call my book cyber war. I think the notion of strategic standalone cyber war is hyped. We have vulnerabilities that could put us at a tremendous strategic advantage in the world, in statecraft, in commerce, and in every other way. But, you know, we tend in this country, when we want people to take something seriously, to hype it up.
I'm going to have to jump in here because we are out of time. Joel Brenner's new book is called America the Vulnerable, Inside the New Threat Matrix of Digital Espionage, Crime, and Warfare. Joel, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Hey, it was good. I'm sorry I didn't end on quite a good note. I should have been watching the clock.
It's quite all right. Thank you.
Today's
show was engineered by Justin Martin. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.